The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2023. This is the first stream, and I'm here with White Papers, that is James and Cyan. So before we begin, I should just check that everything's going okay on the various platforms, because this is quite a technical leap from last year. So, in the meantime, I hope you all enjoyed the intro. Now let me just check, if anyone is actually watching. Let's see. Okay, I think Twitter isn't working this time. That's weird. Okay, I'll have to fix that later. And then Odyssey, I'm fairly sure will be working. Yes, it's going. And then Telegram, let's see about Telegram. Yes, it is going. All right. Okay, good. All right, so thank you. Sorry about if you're going to watch on Twitter. I'll have to sort that out after this stream. As I said, it's quite a leap, so I'm still getting used to stuff. Okay, so White Papers. Hello, welcome back to Millennial. James was on last year. And so hello, do you want to introduce yourselves and White Papers to the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, Colin, I helped inaugurate last year and it was a great time. So I was very excited when you asked me to come back. White Papers has more than doubled in size in terms of following and supporters, and way more than doubled in size in terms of the Substack and that sort of stuff. So it's been a really good year. And a bunch of that really good year is down to me bringing Cyan onto the team. We've been friends for years, and as chief operations officer, all the back-end stuff and all of the support stuff allows me to actually produce a lot more content. She helps co-host the podcast, which is on the Substack, so it's been pretty great. I've been very grateful for my year. It's been fantastic.
Yes, excellent. It's just short of 10,000 subscribers now on Telegram, I believe.
Yes.
I think you had I seem to remember it was about 3,000 when you appeared last year.
So it was about 3,000 last year.
Yeah, so it's been a fantastic, very successful year for you. And I'm not surprised, because White Papers is a very useful resource. Cyan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, well, thank you. That was a really, really kind introduction by you, James. They let me out of the back office here for a little bit to come on the stream with you guys. So thank you so much, Woz, for having me on. This is a ton of fun. It's an annual tradition to get to watch it. And so it's really fun to get to be on it, too. And I actually met both of you at the same time in person for the first time back in, I think it was 2019, at the Skanza Forum in Stockholm. And that was one of the best experiences of my life. I met, I think everybody that I work with really closely right now, I met either through that event or because that event. And so James, thank you too for keeping in touch over the years. And you know, we've been working closely together on other projects. So thanks for inviting me onto this one. And yeah, we've had explosive growth, and not to mention some of the key pieces that were written this year on repatriation. Some of those were put out on our Substack. We've had enormous growth there. And so, it was really kind of you to think about me, and I come from a more of an activist background, an administration background. So I was really, really, really thrilled to be asked to come help. So we're looking forward to a good year.
Well, thank you. Substack is a whole thing in itself that we could talk about, but let's not, because
My goodness.
I mean, I've started on Substack this year as well, and I just love it. I think it's a terrific platform. It's a serious platform. You know, it's not
very much
tacky in any way. So I really like that. So, James, let's get to the actual events of the year, because this is what we did last year, and I think it worked very well. It was a sort of introduction to a lot of the events and themes that would be discussed throughout Millennial. And I think that was exactly what happened. So I thought we should do the same this year. So, James, you've given me a list of key things, and I think there are 18. So we'll get through them, hopefully. And I will not interject very often with my own opinion. Because,
oh, no, please do.
No, I won't, because last time we ended up, it was just... We had to rush at the end to get all the other stuff talked about, because I'd rabbited so much about the first five.
I don't think we have to do literally all of them. I do think I want to actually start with the two I put at the end. The first one being, because you have your Twitter back and we are on Twitter now, and that's a very fast growing thing. We're approaching, I think, 1,000 people on there, which is very nice.
Oh, you should have linked me. Right, okay. I'll link it in later.
I'm not a Twitter native, so I don't think about these things. But the big thing there that I was trying to bring up was that Elon Musk took over Twitter, and this has seemed to usher in quite a few changes on that platform. Now, I know not everyone has been unbanned on Twitter, you know, that are in our circles, and that's unfortunate. And I do hope that changes. But there has been a serious change in who can be on Twitter and what can be discussed on Twitter. And, you know, obviously the owner of Twitter interacting with some personalities that everyone listening here would be very familiar with, like Keith Woods.
That's incredible. When you compare it with what it was like, it's easy to forget. Things change and it's easy to forget. Twitter was like a police state. 18 months ago, it was like Kafka-esque, where people would just be banned for no reason. There'd be some bullshit made up to justify it. That was obviously bullshit, and everyone knew it was, but there was nothing you could do about it unless you had tens of millions and were going to take them to court. And even when you did that, the system would back up Twitter. So it was completely random. Well, not random. It was very political, very politicized indeed. Extremely shameless amounts of left-wing bias. Left-wing, it perhaps isn't the right adjective in this day and age, but we all know what I mean. So I think Elon Musk, I mean, there's a huge, and I'm sure this will come up again and again, that it is a very different platform now. And I don't like the new name X. I think it's a absolutely dreadful.
I refuse to use it, generally speaking.
Yeah, I'm refusing for as long as it's practical to refuse until people start wondering what century you're from.
It'll be a mark of our generation.
Yeah, but other than that, the changes are amazing. So I promise not to intervene. So that's all I'll say. If you want to take it over, Cyan.
Oh, no, that's okay. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you said is that, you know, unless you had millions or billions of dollars, you couldn't really engage in lawfare. And so that's probably the most exciting thing, at least, you know, from my perspective, to see is that we have somebody who is willing, somebody who has those vast amounts of money, you might as well use it. He was suing Media Matters and talked about suing the ADL. Maybe he actually did sue the ADL. I guess I haven't been paying attention.
He did not. I wish he did, but he did not. that would have been very nice.
Media Matters, close enough. he's got billions of dollars to lose doing that. So, you know, thankfully somebody has to. And so that's been really encouraging to all of us. You know, one of the things that's on this list that we're going to talk about is the Australia referendum too. And, you know, if Joel Davis didn't have access to Twitter, then he wouldn't have been, this is speculating. You don't ever have to say never, but he wouldn't have had the reach that he would have had to be invited onto national Australian television. television. So, you know, like it or not, Twitter, X, whatever, is the public square. And if you're shut out of that, that's a limitation of your First Amendment rights. And I wish more people would see it that way.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think it's, I mean, some people on our side tend to say things like, well, who cares? The public aren't on Twitter. Yeah, the general public aren't on there, so it doesn't matter. And I think that's very naive. And I often say, if our enemies don't want us to have something, and they desperately don't want us to be on any of the mainstream platforms, then we should wonder about that. That's a clue that we should have that thing. We should want to have that. If our enemies desperately don't want us to have it, that is a sign. And so for us to be back on Twitter is great. Now, obviously not everyone is back, but it's going in the right direction. And as for the climate, the mood on there, it's a lot better. I mean, you don't feel like you're treading on eggshells all the time. And the left, of course, are, I mean, they're so dramatic. I remember there was a phase when they kept saying that it was a hellscape of a website now. And it was a farce of a website. I mean, a nightmare of a website. Come on, for God's sake. I mean, but this is what it is for them. When people can speak freely, it's a nightmare for some, you know, deluded liberal.
When you can post a statistic that they don't agree with.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Oh my God. Like, you know, it's really
shocking.
Quite entertaining.
I
have to agree with your public square comment, Cyan, and then backed up by Woes there, because on the low end, I occasionally look at these numbers. On the low end of the estimates, Twitter has 330 million monthly users. On the high end of the estimates, it's about 530 million monthly users. It's not a dead zone. I mean, no. White Papers has made Twitter posts that have gotten 17,000, 25,000, 30,000 views. And I know people, again, Keith, Joel, they do way, way better. It's not just a space devoid of, the general public and people who look at it. If that were true, you wouldn't have governments that use it. You wouldn't have corporations that use it.
Absolutely. And it's not just about raw numbers either. It's the types of people who use it. I mean, sure, you know, the man in the Clapham omnibus might not have a Twitter account and he might not be interested in what's going on Twitter. But journalists are there. Politicians are there. Corporate leaders are there. Intellectuals are there. Academics are there. It matters. And that's what is unique about Twitter and why, I wouldn't really care if Elon Musk had bought Instagram or even Facebook, which obviously would never happen. But Twitter is unique. Actually, that is an interesting point in itself, that they allowed this to happen. Because Twitter, like Facebook, you would never be able to buy Facebook. You would never be able to buy YouTube. Google would never sell that. They would never give that up. But somehow Twitter was left vulnerable to this purchase happening, which is really, I think, a misstep on the part of the regime, because Twitter is, as I say, uniquely important in terms of narrative discourse generation.
That's a really good point. I wonder if the left is going to look at this and start thinking about it in the same way that they thought about the Trump election. Like, oh my gosh, how could we possibly let the orange man win? We can't possibly allow this again. And so I'm grateful that the Twitter purchase happened. And yeah, you're right. Like, I don't see this happening with Facebook or any other kind of social media. You know, just to add to the public square comment, and this is more of, this one isn't really database, this is anecdotal, but like I live in a lot of society, just average people, in their 30s, 40s, and definitely the boomer generation, they operate their societies and communities on Facebook, on social media. You know, Twitter, I don't think is that, like, it's not as age segregated necessarily, but when I live in a small town where if you don't have a Facebook page, then you don't know what's going on. Like, the town council meetings are on Facebook. So like, I have a Facebook that exists, not like for me personally, but it's just like a decoy of Facebook just to know what's happening downtown.
Yeah. Amazing.
So it's very much the public square.
Yeah. That in a different sense, in a different way from Twitter, but yeah, certainly.
I would take the opportunity to move on to another point, which relates to something Colin just said about discourse being generated by Twitter. One of the things we've seen, and I really do credit the Twitter purchase to this to some degree, is that, and this is this is taking from an article of the same name on the White Paper Substack, Mainstreaming the Great Replacement. We have seen that the dialogue of the Great Replacement and about the Great Replacement and surrounding that has gone from sort of an unchallenged accusation of conspiracy theory to people with millions of followers, Musk himself, there is Charlie Kirk. And again, I know people have problems. I have a problem with Charlie Kirk. My goodness, we could do a whole episode, but we're going to skip over that. He has a massive following. You also have Tucker Carlson, who has a gargantuan following. Then you have, you know, the presidential candidate and Vivek Ramaswamy. Ramesh, I can't, whatever his last name is, good goodness.
People just say Vivek.
All of these people and personalities with very large followings who have, you know, sort of reified that, no, it's not a conspiracy theory. This is an actual thing that's happening to Western nations, and they project this overwhelmingly on Twitter. And then it permeates out. The media becomes upset. The media picks up on it. The media writes about it. I think that conservative people permeating this on Twitter gave Vivek the confidence to say it on national television during a presidential debate. These kind of things matter, and they are sort of seminal moments, even if we don't realize it right then.
I completely agree. I think that it's central in that sense. I mean, no one really cares what someone posts on their Telegram channel. And to be honest, that's a bit baffling to me. I think they should. But for some reason, it doesn't make sense because Telegram actually has a huge user base. It's tens of
700 million.
700 million. Yeah, I thought it was 770 million. But no, 700 million. It's huge. And yet it's regarded as a set of closed doors, like a set of compartments, rather than an open public platform like Twitter. So it's not taken as seriously as Twitter is, not nearly. So they won't talk about what you've said on Telegram, but they will. The media will go mad about something you've said on Twitter. So it really does matter.
Definitely. I think it's also in terms of the exposure too. I mean, I think a lot of people use Telegram, I may be wrong with this, but I think a lot of them use it as messaging and international messaging. And so it's less seen as, if you want to have a discussion with something that someone's posted on a Telegram channel, then that might appear in the comments, but there's less interaction between users. But on Twitter, it's like, you can talk to anybody. Elon Musk can respond to Keith Woods about freedom of speech in Ireland.
Yeah, I can insult a BBC journalist and get blocked by him, like happened just the other day.
There you go.
Yeah, and it is weird, though. It is weird to think, because actually, of all things, I walked past this BBC journalist in Chelsea 20 years ago. And at that time, Twitter didn't even exist. And I remember seeing him, and I thought, that's John Simpson on the street. And then all these years later, he says something stupid about climate change. And I disagreed with him. I said, do you just believe everything the powerful tell you? Are you that much of a slave? And he blocked me.
Oh, no.
But as I say, Twitter is the only place that could happen. So, yeah, interesting. All right, well, let's move on to the I think the timeline is good. The chronology of the year is useful. So the first item is the storming of the Brazilian presidential palace by Bolsonaro supporters. Now, we don't often talk about South America on Millennial, just for obvious ethnic reasons. But James, would you like to tell us about the significance of this? Because obviously Bolsonaro is a figure and everyone's heard of him.
Right. The reason I put this in here is because it connects to what happened in a white country, which is I like to call it the Capitol tour, the people who went on the tour of the Capitol on January 6th. It was not a riot.
Unauthorized tourism.
Right. Unauthorized tourism. The Brazilian one was a bit more evidently violent, but it's connected. You do seem to finally be getting this manifestation of people who are of a right-wing persuasion, where they're starting to realize that there are very serious consequences when you lose an election, regardless of how good the guy actually is who governs. We can complain about that later. There are serious consequences when you lose these elections, and years of going, oh, well, imagine if it was the other side whenever the left achieved a victory. We're finally getting out of that phase. That's what this represents to me. And I'm not saying anyone should, you know, go do any kind of violence, but it is a serious gain in the sense that people are finally getting over that hump. You don't just huff and put your hands on your sides and go, oh, well, the left won again. No, when you lose, it's very serious because they are on a very serious march to a very dark place at the moment.
Yeah, and I think that we're seeing the falling away of, frankly, an older conservative, what would you say, age group, generation, who for whom that was the attitude. Oh, the left have won again. And oh, look what the crazy leftists are doing this week. Our generations, Gen X, Millennial, Z, I think we know that the left is not a bunch of clowns and it's not a joke. And they are literally transforming. It's visible. It's absolutely obvious. They're transforming us. They mean everything they say. Whereas the boomers are still in this. And I'm sorry to harp on about the boomers, but bloody hell.
You know, it's okay. I love to do that.
Yeah. It's a guilty pleasure. They're still in this attitude of, it's all, look what they're doing. Oh, well, it'll blow up in their face. Go woke, go broke. And it never fucking does happen.
Exactly.
It never does blow up in their face. So stop laughing about it. It's not a joke. Well, I mean, our civilization's literally being fucking murdered over the course of your lifetime, and you still haven't realized.
I always remember the old Tory quip that conservatism isn't a dogma, it's a disposition, right? Like, you're so superior because you're just above the humdrum day-to-day political operations of the left. And that is an old-fashioned attitude. I'm 24 years old. No one my age has that attitude. I don't know anyone in their 30s who has that attitude. They look at the things that are happening and they view them as actual, tangible events and policy changes that are taking place that are going to affect your life. And not even that they're going to. They already are. We live in an era where these policy changes profoundly affect the way we live right now. That's why this is changing.
Yeah.
Right.
I remember you saying that to me a couple of years ago that about young people in Sweden. And interesting. I find it more plausible now than I did then. At that time, I was kind of sort of baffled at what you told me, but now it seems much more obvious. Cyan, sorry, you were going to say something.
Oh, no, that's okay. Well, you know, the thing that I take from the Brazilian experience that relates to all of this and the difference in opinion in younger people versus boomers especially is that when you know, it's one thing to say, oh, you know, this doesn't affect us, or the Great Replacement doesn't affect us, the decline of the white majority doesn't affect us, when you still have a house, you still have a car, you still have a job, you still have your family, and you're still technically the majority. But what's interesting about Brazil is when Bolsonaro was elected in 2018, I think the white population was 47%. And so whites started to realize, you know, they recognize that they already are a minority. And on top of that, after so many years of leftist rule, their economy is in tatters. It's difficult. You know, you can't hold these higher than thou opinions when your money is literally worthless. When you have less to lose because your economy is falling apart, then you're less worried about virtue signaling. You know, you can't afford to virtue signal anymore at that point. So I think like Brazil is an interesting example in how it relates to the United States, because also like South Africa, I mean, people point to South Africa as one potential future, and then also Brazil is another potential future. And I think Brazil is also accurate because it's multi-ethnic in the same way that America is. And I think especially now, you know, we're seeing the decline of our own economy. We're financing all of these foreign wars. Millennials, even before we were financing the war in Ukraine and now also the war in Israel, you know, millennials can't afford to buy a house. You know, what's going to happen to Generation Alpha?
Yeah, there's this phenomenon of people living in these box. It was in Los Angeles, I think, and it was obviously an extreme case, but it's the point is that it's, versions of this are happening everywhere. This thing in Los Angeles was a bunch of hipsters living in a big room that had, each of them was in a bunk bed, and this was adults living it would be like what you'd stay in on a school trip when you're 13, 50 years ago. Now it's grown adults with jobs.
It's a return to the poorhouses of the 19th century, except these people also have jobs, which makes it even more remarkable.
Yeah, right. There are all these memes. I'm one of the people who's on Instagram just for the memes. And one of the common memes is you see the Harry Potter. It's like Harry Potter's house, room under the stairs. And the tagline is, "This is a New York apartment. You can have it for $2,600 a month." It's so posh.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it's bad. It's really, really bad right now. New York is going broke. New York City Mayor, Eric Adams is basically pleading with people to stop sending migrants up there. It's costing taxpayers like $20 million monthly to house these immigrants. So they're going broke, and New York can't afford it. They already have a homeless problem. So I think, again, what's interesting about the Brazil situation is that it's another one of these countries that we can look to for an example of how when whites become a minority and when the economy falls, our politics are going to be radicalized really, really quickly.
This is something that I've said for years, and numerous people have said for years, that progressivism is a creed of luxury and comfort, and a lot of the delusions rely on that comfort. And once it's gone, people aren't going to be thinking about the starving millions in Africa or trans lesbian midgets and all this. It's going to get much more
goodness.
Is it even that far fetched at this stage?
No. I actually had this discussion with a friend the other day. To be brief, before we move on to the next point, he was making the point that, people have to be very materially uncomfortable before things change. And I made the point really forcefully to him that, yes, and we've been saying that for years. I've been in these politics for a decade. People have been saying that for a decade. But guess what? The decline in material comfort is here. We're living through it right now. This is it. The material Europe Absolutely. Is becoming poor at the most incredible rate. And it's happening so quickly that, people can't connect the dots in their head all at once. Europe, continental Europe in particular, more so than the Anglosphere, is becoming poor at an incredible rate. The Germans are becoming poor at an incredible rate. The Swedes are becoming poor at an incredible rate. The Italians have been poor since they joined the euro. I mean, the thing is coming apart.
That's right. One of the statistics that you found a couple weeks ago, James, is that 48% of parents in Europe are skipping a meal in order to ensure that their children are fed.
Yeah, they've reported doing that, yes.
And we still think that we live, such materially comfortable lives.
But this connects to the next two issues. The next one being Burkina Faso had their coup. One of this whole Sahel region of states that have had these coups, and they asked the French to leave the country. And then Niger and Gabon also had coups, creating this coup belt. And Africa. And one of the reasons this happened is related to the decline in the power and the prestige of the West. Virtually all of these governments were connected in a deep way to the West. I think there is one exception in there, but it might have been Guyana. But anyway, virtually all connected in some way to the West and then had a coup or devolved into civil war. And part of this is because there's no prestige in trying to be a member of these institutions anymore. There's no prestige in being connected to the French. There's no prestige in attempting to, soothe the United States on the, at the UN General Assembly. And these politics it's changing rapidly in the rest of the world. The West is being left behind.
Yeah. And I think that a portent of this, if that's the right word, was the US having to withdraw from Afghanistan, or appearing to have to withdraw. I don't know if it really did have to withdraw. Maybe it was just a badly handled withdrawal. But either way, I think the message that was sent or received was that America just isn't as powerful as it used to be. And then the same thing with the Ukraine. What a disaster. I mean, they sang the praises of Zelensky and the chances of Ukraine winning for 18 months. And then suddenly, round about the time that the Israel thing happened, but perhaps just before that as well, they started to talk about, actually, it's not looking good. And I mean, that, I think, is a proxy humiliation for the West and for America specifically.
Oh, it's a direct humiliation, I think. People were told that Western, it wasn't even power and might, it was Western moral goodness, Western, you know, ideological perfection and our profound values are going to defeat this evil regime in Moscow. And I'm not going to comment on Russia. White papers, we've been good about not directly commenting on the war itself. But the point is, the public in the West, which is our concern, that's our public, that's our people, they were sold a really weird bag of goods. And are finally to the bottom of that bag of goods, and there was nothing in there of value.
Yeah,
It has shaken the moral confidence of the people who live in our countries.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is one of those things that's going to become apparent in retrospect, that throughout this period, people's confidence in their own countries, their own governments, and their own cultures was degrading by the month. Yeah, just now there's a sense, it's sort of chaotic, but I think retrospectively we'll look back on this as a time when the West was basically falling apart. I mean, we do still have wealth, but not as much as we used to. That's why we have to rely on moral, as you say, moral preaching about, you know, the right thing to do, principles and so on. And our enemies or our opponents are able to just ignore that and just steamroll straight through it. It's amazing, really, to be living through this.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's sort of the neoliberalization of values. You know, first they neoliberalize the economy and they tell you, oh, no, we don't have to produce anything. We don't have to make real goods. Everyone can just have a job that you can be a barber or you can computer pro. We don't have to produce actual tangible things. Now we're being told, oh, we don't have to have actual tangible power. We just have the moral values that are so glorious, they're obviously going to carry us to victory. It's ridiculous. And we can transition right into the next point, which was that I still find it hilarious, the Chinese spy balloon incident over the United States.
This was in February, just to remind people.
I noticed that this profoundly demonstrated the contempt that younger Americans have for their own government and nation. Because when the balloon was floating over America and the federal government wasn't shooting it down, there were demands every day for it to shoot it down. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Telegram, I have Snapchat. Every young person has Snapchat. And it's all my normie friends and families on Snapchat. Everyone is like under the age of 45 are posting memes about America being scared and afraid and cowed and weak by this, you know, Chinese weather balloon floating over the United States. And they eventually shot it down after it had crossed beyond South Carolina into the ocean. And then what happened was America kind of went wild and they were shooting random things out of the sky for a while. Everyone knows I'm from Michigan. I talk about it all the time. There were balloons. And when I say balloons, I mean like...
It really like is like something from a surrealist comedy.
It is. There were like helium balloons, not like a party balloon, slightly bigger, but they were just balloons. Like you could buy them at the store, balloons, floating over a lake, Lake Huron, and they scrambled fighter jets and shot these things down. And they were getting relentlessly mocked for that. Like, no one takes this thing seriously anymore. Everyone understands on some level, even if they're not, you know, sort of self-reflecting and going, wow, I really think that I don't take this system serious. You know, people aren't thinking that deeply, but everyone sort of realizes if you're under the age of 50, that this is not, we do not live in a serious place. We are not govern. We're not governed by people who are looking out for us. They have serious interests. Don't get that wrong. My goodness, do they? But they're, you know, they're not seriously concerned with, you know, sort of the historic, tangible things that a sovereign state is supposed to be concerned with. Everything feels like it's kind of a joke.
Yeah. And a prequel to that was when China, I think it was China, sent a hypersonic missile around the Earth. And I think this was like in the middle of last year. And America said, like the American government spokespersons, spokeswomen, whatever, said that they hadn't even been aware that it was there. Something like that. Do you remember this? Because it was a weird thing. It was a weird admission to make. Because it's basically
I don't remember, but I do believe you. I mean, do believe you.
I'm certainly not making it up. It's possible that I read something that's incorrect, or you know, but I think it was real. It was a hypersonic missile, and they said that we would have no defense against this. Which again, that might be utter incompetence to say something like that, or it might be. We actually do have defense against it, but we want you to use it so as to prompt a conflict. I don't know. Why else would you say that? It's a very strange thing. And as I say, I'm pretty sure this is real. As someone will correct me in the chat if I'm remembering this wrongly, but I'm pretty sure this happened around about the middle of last year. But either way, the Chinese spy balloons definitely did happen. Was it ever confirmed that they were actually spy balloons?
The one they shot down that floated over the country was a legitimate Chinese spy balloon.
Right.
And I just remember, it was, the memes were so funny. There were so many memes of this thing floating through the air, and they'd have like General Milley cowering under a tree with this really kooky Chinese music playing. The whole thing was hilarious. Absolutely everyone was mocking the Department of Defense just to death. It was amazing. It was probably one of the highlights of my year, frankly.
Right, but no, we don't live in a serious country. And right. If you actually, you know, we can tell that by the treatment of the southern border. And if you actually took China seriously, I mean, the bigger threat is the Chinese people who are actually here. one of the things that we talked about earlier in the year, this is part of the repatriation series, was the deportation of Chinese, Asian students generally. I mean, if you think about the Chinese population in the United States, you've got, I think UC Berkeley is 20% Chinese students. And then UW, it's 22%. That's the University of Washington, sorry. it's 22% Asian. I don't remember if it was broken down specifically by nationality. But, they also buy up a lot of property. When I worked in insurance, I would get calls all the time from Asians, well, specifically Chinese, who were looking at purchasing places just for rentals. And then they would rent it to some relatives who were staying there. So, and we had to kind of figure out how that insurance situation worked out. And I think they own this is also a problem in Victoria, BC. They're not only changing the culture, but they're also buying up massive amounts of real estate. What I think it's over $6 billion of real estate that they bought in 2021 or 2022. They also own a lot of agricultural land. So, if we actually took China seriously, then we would look at
Deal with these things, right?
Like, right, right.
the fact that the Chinese commit more corporate, now all the East Asian countries do a lot of corporate espionage, but the Chinese commit more corporate espionage than anyone else on the planet. They just pilfer things left and right, and we just let them in, right? Like, come to our most prestigious research universities. Oh my goodness, how did the Chinese figure out this new alloy? Like, oh, I wonder. Like, it's definitely not the kid speaking Chinese.
I find the thing. It was from October 21, and it says, the United States is very concerned about China's development of hypersonic technology, the U.S. disarmament ambassador, Robert Wood, has said. after reports that Beijing had recently launched a hypersonic missile with a nuclear capacity. And he said, "We just don't know how we can defend against that type of technology."
Wow, that's an incredible foot in the mouth. You're a sovereign. You should never admit that. Good goodness.
Incredible.
Look at the, but actually this sort of rolls into point number four. And a lot of people may not be aware of this, but one big thing on the international stage that happened this year, and an example of how serious these people are about certain other things, was that the nations of the world came together to sign the High Seas Treaty, which is essentially an environmental protection treaty. And I know a lot of people would say, well, environmental protection's really great. And in general, I agree with you in terms of, you know, preserving forest for people to hike through or something. But what this treaty did specifically was it enshrined for the first time in international law this myth that in quote-unquote indigenous populations are somehow like endowed by the almighty creator with a sense of environmental preservation. A lot of people who live in Australia and America and Canada will be familiar with this. There's this narrative that these Native American and First Nations and Abos, you know, these people somehow, some way, just know how to be fantastic stewards of the land. They just know how to take care of the sea. They just get it inherently. It's a part of their DNA. And this is now enshrined in international law. Sovereign states are now expected to adhere to this. It's a pretty big change that went under the radar.
Right. And I hadn't even heard of this, actually.
Right, so, yeah.
It's certainly under the radar. I know that the Aborigines in Australia, one of the things they're famous for is burning down so much of the vegetation and the trees and forests and so on. And you know, this is an endangered numerous species, including the koalas, I believe. I mean, and you know, they have an IQ of something like 65, don't they? I mean,
the Native Americans are
going to be good stewards of the land.
But this Australia does this. Australia signs land over to them to be the stewards of. America does the same thing. There's a narrative in America is that these people just have an innate understanding of how to take care of the environment. The federal government's been signing over pieces of national parks to these people to manage. And but, you know, I was just reading today because it's a tangential issue that interests me. There's a popular meme in America that it was the white man who hunted the buffalo basically to extinction to deal with Indians. That's not true. The Indians hunted the buffalo essentially to extinction, and the white man got in on like the last 5 years of it. The Indians got horses and they killed like 6 million of these things a year from 1840 to 1880. And it was only in the 1870s that more than 1,000 white people even lived out there. But we are all told this meme, and it's now gone global. It's now a global meme that they're actually making policy off of, that these people know how to take care of the natural environment.
That's wild. Are you familiar with the maxim from the... Well, I don't know if... This is from Jared Taylor. I don't know if this is from an interview with Japanese media or if this is just a quote that he regularly uses, but it's basically whale hunting is really, you know, culturally traditional in Japan. And he was told at one point, you want to save the whales, we want to eat the whales. So there are big cultural differences in how people treat wildlife. And yeah, well, a lot of the great American conservationists were, you would think of today as right wingers, Madison Grant.
Look, and awesome. the thing is, you can see this. I don't know how to say this in a tactful way, but if you look at the way that certain ethnic groups treat their local environment, you know, in our own countries, their areas tend to be shitholes. They tend to be a mess. They tend to be untidy. They tend to be unclean. I just don't think they care about these things as much as we do. I simply don't see it. I dare say that there are Chinese cities that are well run when it's systematized, but I think on an instinctual level, Indians, Pakistanis, Africans, and Chinese, I don't think they care. It's just visible, and that's even in an urban environment, which is largely built around convenience. And there's not, and when you get to the natural world, that's not. I mean, they don't even have an ancestral connection to our landscapes, our climates. So again, why would they care about this stuff? I just think it's obvious. And then a connected thing is in Britain, we've got this rail project, HS2, and they're going to tear up large sections of the countryside to do this. And from what I can see, it's largely Jewish investors who are behind this.
HS2, Peter Hitchens has a whole thing on this very briefly, but HS2 is essentially just a way for the British government to subsidize a whole bunch of private construction firms. Railways already exist between these cities that went.
I've never heard anyone saying that they want this, so that there's a need for British rail system is fine. It could do with improvements, but we don't need this.
Actually, the point being, you're absolutely correct, and Peter Hitchens makes the point that we already have rail lines that aren't in use because the British government hasn't prioritized rail. Just refurbish the rail lines. Do you really need a train that goes 250 miles an hour in Britain when you could have a train that goes 180 miles an hour on track that already exists?
Exactly.
For, you know, the love of God.
Exactly. And it's not a huge country. I mean, the distances aren't, the journey times aren't.
They're doing this to subsidize a whole bunch of construction firms. And, you know, I do think that when politicians approve this stuff, they think it's going to be a prestige project in a way, but the public, number one, most of the public doesn't care. And number two, most of the public goes, oh great, another tax dollar boondoggle. Like, people are just used to this at this point.
Yeah, completely. There's a widely understood relationship between government and big business that is rarely, you know, in the interests of the general public, for sure. I mean, yeah, that goes back a long way. But yeah, the corruption, I don't think, has been quite as blatant in the past as it is now. I mean, the Tory party, especially in Britain, is
my least favorite.
It's absolutely corrupt.
They're horrible. Goodness, I want the Tory party to go away. In my lifetime, I hope they go away. My goodness. But we can...
not bedposting, we're
no, no, I want them to fade from history. That's all. I don't want them to be electorally viable.
Absolutely.
That's my serious wish. But speaking of electorally viable, a really big thing that happened this year was related to the Israel... Netanyahu specifically tried to change the judicial system of Israel, and this led to a bunch of protests. But the really interesting thing that happened here was that this before the conflict with Hamas, you have to, you know, bifurcate here. Before the conflict with Hamas, the Israel lobby in the United States and the politicians that are represented in that lobby and the actual Jewish policymakers in Jerusalem had begun to diverge significantly. They had a really cold relationship. Blinken, the American Secretary of State, who is himself Jewish, went on stage with Netanyahu and actually called him out on stage. This system is sort of, you know, this sort of ethnic group at the core of how America makes policy and the European Union to a great deal. That had started to fracture before this war, and I found that to be really significant, incredibly significant, actually.
Definitely. Blinken does seem to be, he's an interesting figure, because he does seem to not be completely evil. He does seem to have a conscience.
He's one of these Zionist power brokers who, you know, he falls into sort of like an optics, right? Like, he's really happy for the sort of slow roll colonization of the West Bank. Don't antagonize Hamas. You know, Israel up to this point has gotten almost everything it wants all of the time. You know, please don't bomb people. That makes us look bad. And of course, Netanyahu goes, oh my God, fire another bomb. And we're seeing this happen live right now. And I do think that was a pretty significant development. Unfortunately, it didn't hold, of course, because now we have this full-throated conflict between Israel and Hamas, and the politicians in the West have been saying the most disgusting, horrific things, especially American politicians.
Oh, yeah, but let's get to that when we get to that.
That's true.
Let's stick with the chronology, because obviously there's a lot to say about that. So, but that sets the stage for it, in a way.
Yes, it does.
So thank you for including that.
Another global political developments that have also happened this year, and the best exemplar of this, is that the Finns party, which is a true Finns party, which is a nationalist party in Finland, that they range on the spectrum. They have like some cucky civic nationalists. In fact, they have a gay guy who's married to a black guy who's in the party. Then they have this. Yeah, I know. Right. Then they have this really hardline ethnic nationalist wing. And a couple of those people were actually in the government before being kicked out. But this party is actually part of the government in Finland now, and this sort of follows the trend of the Sweden Democrats supporting the government in Sweden and Georgia Maloney and the recent election that happened in the Netherlands that we'll get to later. There is this slow rolling development of European populations looking at these parties and saying, okay, that things are getting bad. Things are kind of ugly. I'm getting poorer. I think a lot of people do have the sense that, or got the sense at one point that there was a willingness to send people to die in Ukraine. That didn't happen, and I don't think that's going to happen at that point, but that was a tangible thing I think people were feeling. Most of Europe, you and I actually lived through it last year, the incredible expense of electricity and petrol, and you know, this has led to people looking at these politicians and saying, okay, that's an alternative we haven't tried for a while, that being nationalism, and people are looking at it. Of course, there are problems with these parties. Georgia Maloney is terrible. I could go on for ages about how awful that woman is. My God, does she disgust me. But the point is that people are looking to these alternatives, which means eventually they're going to wander across people who are much closer to our ideas, and that people with our ideas who are serious about them have a path forward to sort of, public perception and power, frankly.
Things are moving in the right direction. I do agree with you on that. And then the next thing is NATO expansion, with Finland joining and Sweden not joining. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, so this, the interesting thing there is particularly it's Sweden, which is being kept out by Viktor Orban. Viktor Orban is such a fascinating character. He is doing incredible amounts of damage to this system from the inside. He really does fascinate me. I really do like him as a politician. He really has been good for Hungary. And he really has been good for Sweden. I mean, good Lord, again, he's keeping us out of NATO. And that's pretty significant. Again, you have the small country of 9 million people in Hungary, and Viktor Orban is standing up to this whole miasma of, you know, the most disgusting, decrepit institutions and saying, I don't think so.
Yeah, he is an interesting figure. And again, I expect he'll be discussed in Millennial at various times. And then another one is nuclear power coming to an end in Germany. And this really, I remember when Nord Stream was blown up last year, and there were German politicians celebrating it because it tied them. It severed Germany from Russia. It made them more dependent on America. And I mean, it's just astonishing to think that German politicians would celebrate Germany being made weaker economically. But I think their self-hate is so ingrained, it's so deep, that anything which weakens Germany, they see as actually a good thing.
There are two things at play here. Number one is exactly what you said, which is the self-hate thing. The other one, though, is, again, because Germany, I mean, legally it's a sovereign state, but in terms of disposition, they just go along with absolutely every crazy idea that comes along out of any international institution. And one of the things they're doing here with Germany is they're saying, all right, you're shutting down your nuclear power plants because we are seriously testing the idea of attempting to put you on some kind of mostly renewable grid. I mean, yeah, Germany's had to fire up some coal-fired power plants in the meantime, but my goodness, are they throwing up wind power, wind turbines, and you know, every house is being blanketed with solar panels, and they're turning fields and fields of what was once agricultural land. They're burning it and putting solar fields on it. They're really attempting to make Germany the test case for this, is really what I think is going on here. And they've sacrificed what was essentially the last truly wealthy, productive white country, and they've essentially slit its throat and thrown it onto the woodpile.
God almighty.
Yeah, that is really remarkable that they would agree to it, but it's just, I mean, like both of you said, they have to be self-hating by nature, because after World War II, I mean, God forbid if they had any sort of national identity again, otherwise we'd have like Holocaust Part II. So yeah, that's why they have these, you know, state institutions like the Verfassungsschutz or like the Office for the Protection of the Constitution. You know, they have to adhere nationally to this ideal of liberalism, or else, you know, the other nations won't cooperate with them. So, yeah, you know, it's really disappointing. But that also, you know, is that the rise of the AfD is really encouraging in that sense too, you know.
Definitely.
So there is some pushback.
Definitely. And there will be a guy connected with the AfD appearing on Millennial this year. So that whole thing.
We'll be listening.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that. That's Stefan Kort.
That'll be good. But we can move on to a moment of of hilarity in Britain. Obviously, his Majesty the King Charles III was coronated. And I actually enjoyed most of it. I watch, you know, I enjoy I think state pageantry is a beautiful thing. I really do enjoy it. And the British do it better than anyone else. And
yeah, it is good. I mean, I wish I could believe in the royal family as an institution.
Right, well, right. But the pageantry is great. And I was really enjoying it, you know, aside from having to sit through Rishi Sunak reading a passage from the Bible, which was one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen in my life. But I'm sitting here, and I put this in purely for levity, sitting there watching this coronation of, you know, the first king in 70-odd years, and all of a sudden, there's this group of, like, six or seven black people shucking and jiving in the middle of Westminster Cathedral.
And that was just unbelievable. And he'd said in advance
totally
that he wanted
it
to be multicultural and global and all this stuff. And the result was that. It was just a joke. It was a farce.
It was so incongruous with the whole rest of the ceremony. And I just... I'm laughing now. I'm going to tear up. It was because they literally were like bent over halfway, shaking side to side. I completely lost it. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, here we are in 2023.
This is the kind of thing that would once have been in a comedy film.
Yes.
Where
absolutely.
Everyone has to awkwardly pretend to not find this, you know, ridiculous
right.
and primitive and all that. Well, now we do. We literally do. You've got these highly cultured, highly educated people all pretending, oh, isn't this lovely?
Right.
But this isn't primitive. This belongs in this environment in Westminster Abbey. And
I have a question. So I'm one of the only Americans who doesn't get into the whole royal family thing. And so I you know, just saw this list a few minutes ago. So what happened? I mean, were these people who were part of the ceremony, like, you know, diversity, or they just happened to be there?
They were part of the ceremony. But the interesting thing about it for me was that they didn't take part in anything else. Literally, His Majesty the King and the Queen were sitting there in the whatever the back of the chapel part of the abbey, whatever it's called. And this you know troop of five or seven black people just came out of nowhere. They came right out and they did this whole shuck and jive sort of pseudo soul, you know, swinging these big black ass around thing, and then they were gone. It was just like 3 minutes of shame almost, and then they disappeared.
Oh, God almighty. It was dreadful stuff. Dreadful.
It was another highlight of my year.
But what can you say? And of course, Charles, the King Charles, His Majesty, King Charles III, he seems to be really into this stuff as well.
He does. You know,
all sorts of globalism and the climate change, you know, all of it.
Yeah, he's a member of. He's been a lifelong member. There's some society in Rome. I can't remember the name of it. An Italian-based society. It's only for men. He's a member of quite a few of these male-only political organizations. But essentially, what they all have in common is that they're all for the advancement of sort of these transnational policy goals: environmental, social, ecological. Like, that is what he's dedicated his entire life to, and now he's, you know, the head of state.
Yeah, it's the World Economic Forum type stuff, where it's technology, technocracy, and, you know, redistribute stakeholder capitalism, all of that kind of stuff. He seems to be completely into that and has been for decades, but
yeah,
we didn't really realize.
He spent his whole life doing this.
Yeah, I don't think we realized 20 years ago or even 10 or 5 years ago how dense a nexus this actually is. COVID really brought that into focus, that this is a huge thing. It's a sort of a system of NGOs, corporations, and private members' clubs and so on that are influential. And people were still grappling with this, how influential it is, how powerful it is, how predominant it is. We don't really know. But
right. I mean, for example, the WEF kind of fell out of this being the center of that, I think, because they've had, again, it's a corporate membership club, essentially. But the thing that it represented that does exist is that you have all of these businessmen and policymakers, and in other cases, these heads of state, who they meet in very, very private forums and decide these things. You know, the WEF is sort of just this public example that they were trying to, you know, let's try to mass mediaize it. But these private forums are very real. They exist. Again, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations in its counterpart is Chatham House in the UK. Those are very real private membership clubs that have an almost direct level of control over the foreign policy of the United States and the United Kingdom. These are real institutions that do real things. They don't just write policy reports that no one but me reads. They make decisions.
Yeah. And I think, that, as you say, there was a lot of focus, including by me and others, on the World Economic Forum a few years ago, because it was so prominent. It was front and center of the whole COVID thing. And then that's personified by Klaus Schwab. I think that he was a dreadful frontman for anything, because he just comes across as everyone always said, a James Bond villain. But, and yes, he does. He's laughable and all that. But that doesn't mean that the whole thing is a joke, that it's fake and it doesn't mean anything. It simply means that he is a bad frontman for it.
Well, yeah,
and
again,
the web itself might be, as you say, largely flim-flam, but it's still an outward-facing
example of these people. Yeah, I mean, again, the Council on Foreign Relations exists. The Center for European, it might be Advancement now, they changed the name, but, you know, Center for European Policy, CEP, exists. These things are real. These people meet in their private buildings with absolutely no oversight, and then Ursula von der Leyen calls them up and says, I have to make a policy decision. Can you send a couple people to my office? And they send a couple people to her office, and, you know, boom, bang, she's made a policy decision that she didn't consult the general public about. And, you know, essentially every government in the West operates this way. They have these private, essentially private membership policy institutions that make these decisions for them. And they're all connected. These people travel between these institutions. People should read the book. Oh my goodness, I'm blanking. Oh, it's Decline of U.S. Power. Hold on, I have to actually look this up because it's such a great book. But
Is that Buchanan one?
No, not the Buchanan one. It's the guy who co-wrote The Zionist Lobby. The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. This is a book by Stephen M. Walt, who co-wrote The Israel Lobby with Mearsheimer. Now, this, The Hell of Good Intentions, he outlines in, and this is a mainstream academic who works at like the University of Chicago. He's very well respected. He outlines in perfect detail how all of these people move between these institutions in America and in the rest of the West that no one has ever heard of that directly inform policymakers on how to make decisions. These things do exist. The WEF was just kind of like the ham-fisted public relations attempt that these people made and failed at. But it is a thing.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Right. Yeah. Well, obviously, there's a huge amount that could be said about that. But let's
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah, keep it like that for now. And
we can move on to one of their stooges was forced to resign, Mark Rutte, finally, after, my goodness, 13 or 14 years in office. Longest serving prime minister in European Union. He was finally forced to resign and call an election in the Netherlands. I found it really fantastic. I've disliked that guy for a very long time. And it's overwhelmingly because he's sort of this epitome of neoliberal think tank policy making governance. You know, he consults with these institutions that the public has no control or influence over. And then, you know, governs a country of 17 million people according to whatever these institutions are telling him to do. He didn't have a single original idea about how to govern a country.
Yeah, I mean, he's the equivalent of what's her name in New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern.
Yeah, yeah, he's the male Jacinda Ardern, essentially, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and just a puppet.
Yeah, I was very happy to see him go. You know, I had watched some interviews with him. And he would have, you know, he would talk about his own ideas, and then you'd look at what his government did, and it was totally incongruent. Every decision he made was something that you could go on to a website of a Brussels-based institution and see this is what they were recommending that you do. And, you know, he's just sort of this natural example of it.
Yeah. Well, I remember jubilation when he resigned. When was that? Yeah. July this year. Because I think a lot of people, certainly in our circles, hated him. Various things, changes that have occurred in the Netherlands under his watch. As you say, it's a long time that he's been the prime minister. And you know, that country has changed a lot. It's still one of my favorite countries. And I was there briefly a few months ago. And it's still a beautiful country. But yeah, the demographics, I mean, everywhere you go in Western Europe, it's quite stunning in a bad way how much everything has changed, especially since 2015.
Right. And we are being demographic. This slides right into the next one, which is that Azerbaijan seized Ingorno-Karabakh from the Armenians. And I know people right now might be thinking, holy crap, what in the world did he just say and why does that matter? Well, the West has allowed Azerbaijan to seize a political entity that was controlled by the Armenians and expel them all. They did an ethnic cleansing. A literal ethnic cleansing is happening, actually, in real time. And the entire Western world, who is, you know, apparently concerned about ethnic cleansing, which may or may not be happening in other faraway...
It's a bad thing. Yeah.
Right. Like, every other ethnic movement is this sort of catastrophic world-ending event, except for this one, for some reason. You know, God forbid we do anything to maintain our ethnic majorities. This is fine, though, somehow, some way, for some reason.
Yeah. Why would you say that is in the case of Azerbaijan?
Well, frankly, it's because they're an incredibly good ally of the Israelis. And the second most, people don't know this, actually, the second most powerful ethnic lobby in the United States behind the Zionist lobby, behind the Jewish lobby, is the Azerbaijani lobby, because the Azerbaijani lobby is connected to the Zionist lobby. Like, these are two peas in a pod, the countries, the lobbies in the United States. So, of course, America's not going to say anything. Israel gave them drones for the war to fight the Armenians. Drones that America gave Israel. I mean, it's just this weird incestuous circle that America, you know, the average American has absolutely no idea what his government is doing.
Yeah. Yeah. God almighty. Again, we could talk about this all night, but
yeah,
we can't just now. There's so much to it. And then the next topic is similar. The use of AI imaging and text generation became mainstream. And now this started almost, I think it was during last millennial or right immediately after it. Suddenly people were using these AI image generators everywhere. It really took off. I think it was, and I remember thinking at the time, it's so sudden. It took place over a few days. Suddenly it was everywhere. And then throughout this year, that's just increased. And again, it's now very much, it's already a familiar thing.
It's a part of life.
Yeah, it's very much become ingrained. And I still don't know what to think about it. But the thing is, it's going to evolve so fast that there's almost no point having an opinion at any particular point. Because it's going to change everything.
Yeah, my original position was every time I would see these, is like, oh, you can tell. Even the ones that are supposed to be real life, like you can see the tell sometimes in the finger or the eye. And I remember 8 months ago, 9 months ago, none of these images could do the human eye correctly. Well, they can now. I don't see one with the eyes that are incorrect anymore.
Even the fingers.
So my position before, which was like, oh yeah, you can tell every time, this isn't a big deal, people should calm down. Now my position is, am I not going to be able to tell in 8 more months? I don't know. That may be the case, unless it's like actually freakishly, obviously cartoonish.
Right. Well, when they have all of these voice modulators now to imitate. I mean, I think one of the funny ones that has been floating around is who's the guy who did the world like nature documentaries?
David Attenborough
does Detroit.
Oh my goodness, I have that saved.
That was
so realistic.
We can't play that here.
Also, there was one. I used one for the millennial trailer this year. The female Tannoy voice at the station. There's waiting room at station, and that's AI. Maybe I should have come clean about that. But I have to say that the rest of it, everything else in there, was made by me. Arduously, so don't worry about feeling cheated. It was just that one voice that is AI. I augmented it with effects and stuff.
But I have to tell you, White Papers is looking into these infographic videos are incredibly popular. That's how people get their information these days. So we're looking into doing that, and I've had people like the gentleman who does Night Nation Review has given me resources. Just input numbers in lines, and you have AI that can just generate these infographics things for you. I haven't done any that I've been particularly happy with, because this is still a relatively new thing, combining large amounts of text with these generators. But it's coming along. It's absolutely fascinating how it's changing sort of productivity.
And I think that's one of the ways in which it's going to change and evolve is. Right now, it's very random. Like, you give it a general thing and it gives you a general response. I think fine tuning it will be, that's how it will evolve. You'll be able to be much more precise and demanding about what it is exactly that you need.
Right. I could generate a video and not like that the graph is orange. And instead of generating a new one, I could just type in, change that color to purple. I think it's going that way as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really exciting and fun. I think it's great to ask things to ChatGPT and see what it comes up with. But it does improve productivity, and I'm all for extending our natural abilities. I think that that's really important. I'm not a traditionalist in that sense. I think that if we can do more things, then that's a good thing generally. But the dark side to all of this stuff is that is the violations of privacy, of course. Downloading ChatGPT is not, it's free for us, but it's not free in the same way that Twitter's not free or Facebook's not free or Google's not free, because it's taking your data and your information, and who knows what they're going to do with it.
And also it's going to make a lot of people unemployed and unemployable, because it's just going to do their work for free instantaneously. What it would take a graphic artist hours and hours to do, it will just spit out in milliseconds. I mean, that's going to screw over a lot of people, millions and millions of people, the middle class as well as the working class. So it's going to have hugely transformative effects on society, I think, AI.
Right. Well, and
I completely agree.
Not only that, but the personal data that you're feeding it and all of the things that make that AI technology better, you know, it's not owned by a neutral company or a neutral government or just neutral humanity. You know, it makes these companies like Google that much more powerful players in the global scale too. Just a few years ago, there was a case where Google was providing information and AI learning, to Israel to use in their military. They have AI remote controlled machine guns now at the border. I think it is in where they can identify, people based on biometric data, and they can, put down resurgence and things like that. So, I mean, that's a dark way of thinking about it, but dystopia is already here.
It's true. There's one thing I always think about the last three times I've flown. I have a passport. My passport has my picture in it. It is my identity. But the last three times I have flown, they've just had me stand in front of this camera to get on the plane. Like, the camera takes a picture. I didn't present them my passport. I've never given these people this picture. I've never given them any information about me. They just have the data. They've just collected the data from, various sources, or, when they issued my passport 8 years ago. And I just stand in front of the camera and it lets me on the plane. And I understand that there's a convenience argument, but that freaks me out. Really, I would rather hand a human being my passport than this, phone on a stick takes a picture of me and goes green and tells me I can get on the plane. Things like that, in terms of privacy, profoundly disturb me.
It does feel like some sci-fi dystopia stuff. It's the kind of stuff you've seen in films, about the near future. Could this be how we'll live? And the answer is yes. It is how we are living now. And it's annoying. And obviously none of us get any sort of choice in it. You're not going to be allowed to have the option of showing a real person your passport.
I think the last time there was a serious discussion about data privacy was over 5 years ago. It's not a thing anymore. It's not being discussed anymore. In fact, when people do discuss it, the first thing you hear is, oh my God, it's the conspiracy theorist people discussing data privacy. And it's like, no, I'm not talking about chemicals in the water turning the frogs gay, for Pete's sake. I'm talking about the fact that every time you go on the internet, you give a load of personal data to a corporation. That is a real thing that we actually have to deal with.
Yeah.
There are policy concerns there.
It's a huge area, whole thing, and we could talk about it all night. Let's move on to the next item, which is obviously, I would say, the main event from this year, which is the Israel-Hamas war. James, do you want to take that?
Absolutely. I have written several pieces on this. One did incredibly well, called America's Appalling Ally. And again, with the Israel-Hamas situation, generally what White Papers does when it comes to a conflict is our position generally isn't to declare a side. Our position is to say, how is this hurting our people? How is this hurting white people? How is this negatively affecting us? What actions are our governments taking, supposedly on our behalf? And what are the results of this for us? And I've written a few pieces on this. And at the end of the day, to sort of sum up all of the pieces, it's that we give endless amounts of, and it's not just America, Britain falls into this category, the European Union falls into this category, endless amounts of money and moral support to a country that is now attempting to promote the option, very openly promoting the option, I should say, that 2 million Palestinians have to be resettled into the West. This is now a part of mainstream dialogue. John Bolton, who's a former national security advisor, is saying that America needs to take in 2 million Palestinians. the Greek government, now they actually issued a warning, but the Greek government issued a warning that said, like, no, it's a serious possibility that these people are going to be dumped on the European Union. People have to take this seriously. Israeli Knesset members are writing about this. A former deputy director of the Mossad is writing about this. Chatham House had a blog post about this a couple weeks ago. The end result of this war that our governments are funding is that we're going to have 2 million new Palestinian neighbors if it keeps up at this rate.
And it is ethnic cleansing.
Oh, yeah.
And these people are supposedly barbarians when they're there in Gaza. Right. But when they come to Europe, they'll be wonderful new, fresh blood, young, you know, new energy for Europe. Wonderful.
Well, they're going to pay your pension, Colin.
Yeah, yeah. And they'll be enriching in the jobs that no one wants to do and all this. But in the meantime, they're, you know, savages and barbarians.
They're so dangerous that the Israelis have to airstrike their hospitals.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Again, this is going to be a big topic this year. And several of the streams I'm a bit nervous about because I'm going to have to try to keep it within reasonable limits. Well, but there is obviously so much to say about it. It's a huge thing.
There is. And we don't do war coverage. One thing I've always avoided with white papers is I don't do like minute by minute. This got bombed. That blew up. You know, I've never done that. Number one, just because I'm not. Number one, I'm not particularly interested in that because there are other people who do it better. And number two, when you're that invested in that minutia, you miss the policy outcomes. You know, if you're keeping track of every tank that's being blown up, I would wager that you're less concerned with the fact that John Bolton wrote an article saying America has to take in 2 million Palestinians. I am very concerned with the idea that America has to take in 2 million Palestinians. I'm also very concerned with the fact that the new speaker of the House, who's from Louisiana, one of the poorest states in the country, is pushing through a bill to give Israel $15 billion when the poverty rate in his state is 30%. And they need $7 billion to fix their drinking water infrastructure. And you're going to give the Israelis $15 billion.
It's just astounding.
Like, why don't you just get on a plane, go back to Louisiana, and kick someone's grandma? I mean, for Pete's sake.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable how obvious it is that, you know, a lot of American politicians simply don't work for America or their electorate, their local area, anything like that at all. They work for a foreign power. It's just it's glaringly obvious. And I think it has, and this is really the key event, the key effect, I think, of the war, is that this has become glaringly obvious to many new people for the first time.
I'd say virtually everyone under 40. I mean, social media is overwhelmingly, I always have a hard time with this. I'd love to see more data. You know, you get groups like the ever vaunted ADL who make comments about how the social media is 70% pro-Palestine. But is that really true? What part of that 70% are people who are just complaining about the fact that their road needs to be repaved, but you're sending money to refill Israeli Iron Dome? And I think that's a legitimate question. The ADL wants everyone to believe that America's like young people in America are just these rabid mass of anti-Semites who hate Israel. I'm really curious about how many of these young people who can't afford a home are furious because their policymakers are focused on Tel Aviv.
Exactly. I mean, what is the hipster in that box thing in Los Angeles who can't afford a proper apartment? What does he think about money being sent, his tax money being sent to Israel?
Exactly. I don't think that he's actually concerned with, you know, flying a Palestinian flag. The people, especially when you look at the protests, the pro-Palestinian protests are overwhelmingly Arabs in the West and a bunch of white women, frankly. That is overwhelmingly the demographic. I'm not saying that all white women are, you know, are going to protest, but that is the demographic on the street. That is just what it looks like in the pictures. You are not getting average, normal, workaday white people in the West going to these protests. No, they're going to work because they have to pay the taxes to pay the Israelis.
Like, you know. Yeah, someone has to pay for the bombs. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there are a few different issues that are coming out here. And one of them is, yeah, well, where's the money going? Well, where's the money for us? And then the other issue is about immigration and free speech, because the important thing to remember about like 2 million Palestinians who are coming here is that just 2 months ago, we had state officials talking about how we should revoke green cards and deport anyone who expressed sympathy for Palestine. So that, like, to anybody paying attention, this to me is the most wild thing, is that we went free.
Non-white immigrants in America, in Britain, all over Western Europe, they are encouraged and even rewarded and even employed and paid to talk shit about white people. And our countries, our histories, our everything, to demonize us. But as soon as they criticize Israel or voice support for Israel's enemy, suddenly they're a danger to public safety, and they should be deported, and their citizenship should be revoked. This is outrageous. I mean, like all of the shit that we have put up with, you know, from Rotherham to Cologne, you know, all of it, the bombings and the endless preaching about how evil we are. We've put up with all of this.
And people take notice. This is the thing. This is why I make the point about the ADL poll. Most people are just, they're actually, again, most people sort of under the age of 40 are looking at this and they're saying, well, holy crap. You know, that one guy I saw make a Twitter post 2 years ago about the Zionist lobby, like, holy crap, you know, that guy was correct.
Yeah. I've got a meme somewhere. I won't try to look for it now because it's...
I'll remind you later. You can send it to me.
My meme folder is quite extensive, but I've got this one from a few years ago of a white guy, a student in college, and there are black girls, black women, you know, jumping up on the tables around him. And the caption is... when you realize that the people on 4chan were correct.
Oh goodness. Well, so you know, we're having that moment now. People are realizing that everyone who, whether ham-fistedly or you know, really diplomatically complains about ethnic lobbies that have an incredible amount of influence in Washington, all of a sudden everyone sees it. It's manifest. I mean, for Pete's sake, you have that disgusting woman, Hillary Clinton, who I hate with the passion of a thousand suns, coming out and saying a ceasefire just isn't possible. We just can't have peace with these people. We, you know, Israel has every right to, quote unquote, deal with these people, and then turn right around and say, oh my God, we have to take in 2 million Palestinians. Everyone stops and goes, what the hell?
Yeah. There's all kinds of wacky things going on. I mean, we talked about Blinken a little bit earlier in more of a positive light, but he was one of the first people to go visit Israel and say, I'm here as a Jew. And we're like,
I thought you were our Secretary of State.
Right, like, and then, you know, and then you've got, who is it, Lindsey Graham, who says, you know, we need to, what was the direct quote? It was something like, do whatever the hell it takes to level Gaza. I mean, that's pretty wild coming from like a third party country. And then there's, you know, people who aren't even Jewish, like the evangelical Christians. There was
Peterson.
Oh, Jordan
Peterson. Oh, yeah. Oh, that poor man. He right off his rocker, that guy.
It's like very, very sad. But like, did you guys see the news about Brian Mast? He was that Republican from Florida. He's going out on the Congress floor in his IDF uniform.
Oh yeah! Your, my goodness.
You know, he's not even Jewish. He's just an evangelical Christian. And
join the IDF. Like, I don't. Right. What do you say? That I don't know. I can't comprehend of a way to actually communicate with a person like that.
It's just wild, wild. So. Incredible. It can only go on for so long.
Yeah. Well, that's the idea. I think things are changing. I'll just say that for now.
Very rapidly.
We've got to move on. Even though this is a very important issue, right? So I don't mean to trivialize it. It's just time constraints. So the next thing is the Australia Voice referendum returns a no vote. So they voted, the Australian public voted against this. James, do you want to explain what that referendum was all about?
Absolutely. It was, my goodness, was this incredibly significant. it was essentially the closest that a white public has ever been, has ever come to directly being asked, do you want to give up your country? Because what was happening, what the referendum was going to do was establish this alternative set of institutions completely filled with Aboriginal Australians. I don't know how they would have found enough of them to fill the institutions, but I digress. They were going to fill these institutions with Aboriginal Australians. This was going to be enshrined in the Constitution, and these groups would have had direct access to every level of Australian government in consultation in everything they did. And of course, they presented this as, oh, they're just going to be consulting. They're just going to be able to be in the room when they're needed to make sure that decisions positively affect the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. But it actually, freedom of information requests had revealed that actually what this would have done is essentially given Aboriginal Australians the ability to change the Australian constitution and fundamentally how the country is governed. There was even talk, again, in official government documents about forcing non-Aboriginal people to pay the Aboriginal population rent for living in Australia. Like, you know, imagine you're someone, you know, you're someone whose family has been sheep farming in Victoria for, I don't know, 130 years, and you own your home, you've never paid a mortgage, and all of a sudden they want you to pay rent to some Aboriginal who lives in the Northwest Territory, in the Northern Territory. Like, this was actually the things that were being discussed, and it was an inherently racial referendum, and 60% of the Australian public came back with a no. They essentially were directly asked, do you want to give up your country? And they said, well, no, thank you. I very much like the place.
Yeah. Do you see yourself as an interloper in this country?
Right.
Or do you disgustingly, racistly think that this country belongs to you?
Correct. And they decided that I'm disgustingly racistly, it's my country. And they were correct. And I was very happy with the result. And I did mention in my post that Joel Davis, he had obviously been on Twitter and social media. They had covered him on television. He had gotten into sort of the mainstream newspapers in Australia. And, nationalism played something of a role in the conversation around this referendum.
Right. Well, like 60%, I mean, that's pretty much the percentage. I think it's 60 or 61% that have said Australia has enough diversity.
Yeah. People want to be done with this experiment.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, there are two types of diversity here. There the diversity of the Aborigines and all that, but also the new diversity of the Chinese who are again buying up Australia. So I don't know. I mean, you've got to remember that Australia was, it did have the White Australia policy. I remember there's a soap opera called Neighbours that didn't have any non-whites in it for years and years. I think until, the late 90s or something. It was within living memory, a very, very, very white country, like Canada. It's a lot.
Like Britain.
And Ireland, we don't even need to mention, Britain, absolutely. All of this has happened very much within our lifetimes. So, yeah, incredible. But as you say, that was a good... The other thing about the referendum is, the Aborigines are apparently dying out. There aren't going to be that many of them. In the future, I can't remember the rate of the projected, when they'll become extinct, but apparently it's really shrinking very fast because
What's quite entertaining, Australia, America, Canada, and New Zealand all have this problem of, they're called pretendians, which are white people who on census documents and other official documentation have just in huge masses begun to say, "Oh, I'm an Aboriginal. I'm a Native American. I'm a First Nations person." When they're not, the number of Indians, Native Americans in the United States increased by like 3 million between the last two censuses. And it's estimated that the number of white people pretending to be Aboriginals is something like 800,000 in Australia. So these populations are even more, you know, infinitesimally small than they appear on census documents.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, let's race through, because there are actually a few super chats and we've only got 20 minutes left. So the next thing was the Dutch general election. Now, Mark Rutte resigned earlier in the year, I think it was March, around about then. And then this election happened about a month ago, less than that. And that resulted in, you see, the Dutch system is quite different from Britain.
Horrific.
So there are many different parties. And God, his name is just,
Geert Wilders.
Geert Wilders got the most votes, but not enough to cross the threshold. So what might well happen is that his opposition, which is all the other parties, might well form a coalition in order to get more than get over that threshold, in which case he won't have any real power. James, do you want to take this up?
Yeah, there's there is a chance that he'll be able to form his own coalition if the VVD, which is Mark Rutte's party, wants to work with him. They haven't decided whether or not they want to work with him. Last time I was aware, one of the things that I think is holding them back is the fact that the woman in charge of the VVD now, she isn't Dutch. She's a Turkish Kurdish refugee.
Tremendous.
Who has a name.
She married to a Jewish person too?
I think Sam had said that on our show. Yes.
Okay. It's more tremendous. And
absolutely, absolutely astonishing. And she hasn't decided whether or not she wants to work with him. But again, his...
Oh, mind you, he's married to a Jew, isn't he? Geert Wilders.
I do believe. I do. He also has Asian ancestry.
Yeah.
Regardless, it's another demonstration of the fact that European publics are looking for this alternative. And they're saying, okay, the system we've been living under, number one, is falling apart. Number two, is demonstrably failing. It's time that we try this thing that everyone has told us has been evil for the past 60 years. You know, let's give it a shot. And we're just going to see more and more of this, particularly because the people who are voting for these parties, this is most demonstrated in France and Sweden, but it also happened in the Netherlands, are young people. Marine Le Pen won the largest share of the youth vote in France in the last presidential election. Macron would have lost if he didn't win like 80% of the people who are older than 60.
Incredible. This is so significant. And I think that people should take a moment to realize that, to see the significance of this. Our countries are much less left-wing and centrist than they appear. And it's largely because of the older generations. Now, they did vote for Brexit. And, you know, that in the case of Britain, it's a different situation. But I think in a lot of other countries, it's the young are waiting to, you know, once they gain, what would you call it, electoral majority, these countries are just going to turn, are going to go right wing in a big way.
Oh, yeah. I there's no avoiding it at this stage, essentially.
Interesting.
Particularly in countries like the Netherlands and France, where both men and women are moving to the right. This varies by country. Of course, in Sweden, it's very different. Men are becoming extremely right-wing, while women remain extremely left-wing. But there is sort of this general change afoot that's very exciting.
Yeah. I mean, just when you say that, I think, who would take seriously the political opinions of a young Swedish woman? When you think about the stereotypical young Swedish woman, it's as airheaded and airy-fairy and idealistic as you could possibly be. And yet some people would give that woman the vote. I mean, I just can't imagine. It's just the Nords are notorious for being, well, idealistic, let's say, and well-meaning.
I always say this about Sweden in particular is that there is this weird, perverse pride in the system. The way people look at it is, we built this robust, wealthy, you know, incredible, you know, equality-based utopia that can survive any challenge. we can do anything. This thing that we built that only functions because of the very particular demographics of the group that built it is somehow expected to be able to survive any challenge of integrating any number of just wildly divergent people. It's the most incredible. It's the most incredibly weird, warped sense of pride.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, what was it? A humanitarian superpower. There was
right.
a female Swedish politician who said that. But anyway, I don't want to bitch about Sweden and or about Swedish women for that matter. I've got nothing against them. I'm just saying stereotypically, when you think about a Nordic European woman, yeah, there's a certain idealism. And I remember the three German girls with the refugees welcome posters.
Oh my God. We could do a whole show on the data on that one day. Whoops, I have a ton.
I mean, there's no denying that childless, unmarried women carry the Democrat Party in the U.S. too. Yeah, so.
Yeah. But someone has said in the chat that apparently young Swedish women are turning to the right as well. So
I haven't. Maybe I have to look at the as of last election, the data didn't show that. I'd have to look and see if there's new data.
All right. Let's move on now to one other thing. I just say about the Dutch thing is, again, the Netherlands is seen as a very like the epitome of the liberal Western European country. And so, again, it's very interesting that, mind you, that's not actually true, is it? Because, you know, anyway, okay. So I'm just talking about in terms of international image. The Netherlands is seen in that way. But
they're
anyway.
Viewed as a large L liberal state when in reality they're a small C conservative population.
Yeah.
This is very common.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right, so then the next thing is India is now the most populous nation on Earth.
Yeah, so that was sort of the rounded out at the end there. That's just sort of a horrific idea to me. I'm very happy for India to do what India wants to do in India. That's fantastic. The problem is their economy doesn't grow, they don't create jobs, and they export all of their young men. Go to any street in Britain with a series of small businesses, and my God.
Oh yeah, tell me about it. And they become the CEOs of Silicon Valley.
Right. The new management class.
Yeah, exactly. And some people have said that it's looking like a Brahmin managerial class.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very weird. I mean, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, the Prime Minister of Ireland, the Prime Minister of Portugal.
How does that even happen?
Of course, you have Vivek running in the U.S. and you have Nikki Haley, whose actual name is Nimarata Randhawa. little known fact. I love to remind people of that. Like, no, her name Nikki Haley. Anyway, like, yeah, they're very interesting climbers as a group, and that's sort of frightening, considering that it's now the largest population in the world. Like,
yeah, definitely, and also, I mean, I don't want to make blanket statements, but I just think they're different from us. And I'm happy for them to have a big population in their own country, mm-hmm. happy for that country to become rich, and it's got a space program now and all that. Fine. I just don't want them coming here, changing our culture, decolonizing our curriculums, and leading our companies.
Having two Wally ceremonies in 10 Downing Street.
Absolutely. Exactly. Why would I want that? Sorry, Cyan, go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to comment. That is the depressing thing about Vivek, is that even though it's really exciting that he is mentioning the Great Replacement, people have pointed out, well, you are the Great Replacement.
Right, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of those things where it's a bit of a dilemma, because at least he's saying it. He is actually saying it. And there are non-whites who actually sympathize, or at least they claim to. And
I do think there's a certain segment of these populations that come here or are born here in many cases where they did expect to live a materially luxurious life in a white country. that is what they wanted, that it, or is what they want, but it's, you know, being transformed beyond recognition. And they're like, holy crap, you know, I got to pull up the ladder because these other people are going to ruin it for me. I do think that's the calculation.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I agree. Well, the next things on the list are Musk's takeover of Twitter, but we talked about that already. And then the mainstreaming of the Great Replacement. So we've talked about that as well.
Indeed.
Do we have so that's it. And thank you for that summary of the year. It's very good, James. I think you've hit all the major things.
I tried.
So, yeah, that's great. We'll get to Super Chats now. And let me just see this. Where does it disappear to? Ah, here we go. Right. So there are a few on the other platforms. I should say you can use Ko-fi to do this. You can use Entropy to do it. Or there's the Telegram bot. If you're on Telegram, you can use that. And then there's the Odyssey Hyperchats as well. So many different ways to post questions. Okay, and here we go. This is Cataman55. Do you have a write-up on what you think will happen to or in the USA? Or are you willing to discuss a bit of your predictions just now? Thanks. So do you have a write-up on the, you know, the imminent future of the USA?
Okay, so I'm assuming the demographic situation. Well, our flagship series is the Great Repatriation series, and it's four part. Well, the main part of it is four parts. The Great Repatriation and Hispanics, Asians, Blacks, and the Willing. And we run down in, it took me forever to do this, we run down in sort of excruciating detail, at least from the point of the person who wrote it, very detailed pieces on the origin of these people, how many people have dual citizenship, how many people are eligible for dual citizenship, how, you know, in the case of groups like the Asians, for example, Japan just has a permanent residency visa they will give anyone who's Japanese, regardless of where they come from. We run down in excruciating detail how a relatively peaceful demographic transition back to overwhelmingly having overwhelmingly white countries, in this specific case, the United States, could be done. And the reason that we wrote the series, aside from the fact that it's a policy institution, is that people don't have the sort of bandwidth, and it's not because of a failing of anyone, it's because of sort of the overwhelming nature of modern society, that people don't have a solid grasp on what the situation is. They just see sort of masses of people and they think, oh my goodness, we're done for. When the reality is, no, these people came in a very particular way. We do still have the richest, most powerful state apparatuses in the history of the world. These people can leave in a very particular, relatively peaceful way that aligns with all of the values of modern society, like international law.
So, right.
Go ahead, Sian.
Oh, no, I was just going to reiterate the fact, too, that, you know, it's more, I guess it's not as much of a prediction, but it's a prescription for people who want to put this in motion. For example, one of the popular topics right now is national divorce, and CalExit is part of that. California is seen as a hopeless case in a lot of circles. But if you take the basic measures that are outlined in the Great Repatriation pieces, then California, whose white population is actually pretty evenly divided between conservative and liberal, that could go from being, I think it was 35% to a majority, 61%. So that there's definitely hope there, and we want to give hope to, you know, people who are talking big about immigration enforcement and running on these issues. We want to give them realistic plans forward.
Right. And I would say that if I had to make a prediction, my prediction is that if the stuff is obviously not everyone in the country is going to read my articles, they should, but they're not going to. But that if we can lay this stuff out and enough people can see the material, it's just like if the Heritage Foundation publishes something about economic reform, right? And it becomes a Republican talking point. If enough people become aware that actually the situation is quite salvageable, even in the medium term, that this will enter the discourse. It's already in the discourse in Sweden. It's already in the discourse in France. In fact, we have a whole article, the Mainstreaming the Great Replacement article, is focused on Great Replacement dialogue in France, and the Great Replacement is, it is a reality, and almost 65% of the French believe it, and they're having a national discussion about this. So if we can start the national discussion in America, and by extension Britain and other countries, and we have realistic ideas about how to get this done, and there's a comprehension of it, I think we could be in a very positive place, assuming political developments continue in the direction they're going.
Okay. All right. Briefly, have either of you come across Lionel Curtis? He founded Chatham House and has an interesting association with Milner's Kindergarten and the Round Table Group. In my view, he represents the transition of empire to globalism. Lionel Curtis.
I'm tangentially familiar, and yes, I'm familiar with him because he worked quite heavily with Jean Monnet, who's the man behind the European Union, disgusting piece of human refuse. And so I'm familiar with him tangentially, but I would agree with that. All of these men, whether it be Curtis or it be Monet or it be the post-war administrations in the United States, all of these people made Churchill, actually, all made very conscious decisions to begin the transfer of what was essentially unchallenged national sovereignty to a set of, globe-spanning institutions. If you read the speech, Churchill's a particular... Oh, you're muted there, Woz.
Oh, yeah, sorry. It's a fascinating transition, and it's not documented, really. We don't talk about it enough. How did we go from... What was actually the evolution in the 20th century? How did we go from empire to this, to the Maastricht Treaty and the globalism, you know?
Right.
That whole thing. What was the one? I think it was Maastricht, but there was another one after that. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
Rome. You're essentially correct. And the interesting thing to note is I highly recommend that people go and read the speeches Churchill gave after the war when he wasn't prime minister anymore. He did this tour of Europe and he was giving speeches. And he was explicitly saying, we are going to build this globe-spanning... He was calling it a government. He called the United Nations a government. And he called the UN Charter a constitution. Now, that's not quite what it ended up being. However, he was using these words and he's saying, we're going to build these institutions. They're going to be globe spanning and they're going to have regional pillars. The European Union is the ultimate manifestation of that. And eventually the nation state as an autonomous actor is going to be subsumed by this infrastructure. Now, he thought it was going to happen relatively quickly. It's happened relatively slowly. The intention is there. He said it out loud in these speeches, particularly one in Brussels. Just go read them.
Yeah. We're going to have to really race through the remaining super chats. So thank you for that answer, but I'm going to have to hurry it along because the next one's due in 4 minutes.
Oh, goodness. Okay. So, lightning round.
Yeah. Are you generally white-pilled or black-pilled about the immediate future, the next 10 to 20 years?
Very white. I think this thing is coming apart in the next 15 years. It's my personal prediction.
Okay, Cyan?
Same, white-pilled.
Okay, good. All right, Darby says, the boomers by and large fear change and will sacrifice almost anyone or anything to maintain the status quo.
Yeah, that's true. Anything so that the house and the villages stay standing, I would generally agree with that.
Yeah. Jive Turkey says, here's the thing, white paper, and I don't know what that means, but thank you anyway for the super chat.
Thank you.
Clive says, I'm enjoying this review of the year. Good. Jive says, hey, white papers, can't wait for more boomer bashing on the next By the Numbers. Here's some coffee money, Woz. Thanks for having white papers on.
Excellent. Oh yeah, that was a thing I did with McNabb. We went over all the like generational data of the boomers. That was very funny.
Okay, let's see. And then there are yes, and Hammer just wanted to support. Thank you very much. And Aethelward, yes, I take that point on, but I'm not going to read it out loud. So okay, well, thank you very much. All right, I think that's everything. So sorry for the. Wrapping up very quickly, realized we've only got 2 minutes. So
I think this happened last year.
I know, I don't remember. I was too conversational at the start, so that was my fault. Okay. James and Cyan from White Papers, thank you very much. I'll add your Twitter to the things on the website.
So let me get that for you.
Thank you for that. Just send it to me privately. And I'll get, because I actually didn't know that you were on Twitter, or it had escaped my mind. So anyway, thank you for this. It's been very good. And sorry it's been maybe too fast-paced, but there was just so much to talk about. So
the other guests will get to the detail. We're just setting them up.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, I think this has been a good opener. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Merry Christmas. Happy Yule.
And well done with White Papers as well. I should say that, because it's really been a success story and everyone should follow it. There's really very good summaries and reports of things, and the Substack as well. So, okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much. And I will see everyone else in a few minutes for the next stream with Apostolic Majesty. In the meantime, White Papers, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
We'll be watching. Thanks.
Okay. See you later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated.
All aboard!
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word. We'll be right back.